The following episode of Bread for the People is brought to you by Side Hustle Bread, Long Island's handcrafted artisanal bread company. Side Hustle Bread is a family-run virtual bakery that's bringing the neighborhood feel back to Long Island one loaf at a time. Head on over to sidehustlebread.com for more information, upcoming appearances, and merchandise. My name's Jim Serpico, and this... Should I start with my name, or should I start with "This is Bread for the People"? Do you like it like this? Welcome to Bread, or do you like it like this? Welcome. Ready? Welcome to Bread for the People. Mine... Is there a script? Welcome to Bread for the People. I'm Jim Serpico. Today, I'm here with Elaine Boddy, a food blogger and founder of foodbodsourdough.com. She's an author, sourdough baker, and teacher. Elaine helps people all over the world daily in their pursuit of making sourdough. Elaine lives in the middle of the beautiful countryside in England with her husband, her son, and dog, Bob.
Yep.
How's Bob doing today?
Bob's okay. He's a bit bemused, but yeah, he's good. Thank you very much.
Elaine, there's a saying I've heard growing up here in the United States that I never really thought much about. I think my grandmother used to say, if you do that again, I'll make mincemeat out of you. And I never really thought about mincemeat. It's not something I ever ate, and I didn't even think it was something that you can eat. And as I'm going through your recipes, I find some sourdough that you make with mincemeat. So I do a little research, and I learn a little bit about it, but could you talk about the importance of mincemeat in England?
Okay, so this mincemeat is not mince meat. So it's not okay. The stuff, you know, it's not the stuff that comes from animals. So mincemeat here for us is what we would put in mince pies at Christmas. So I have some actually in the cupboard behind me, which I could have had out if I'd known. But it's a mix of dried fruit, dried peels, often rice, spices, often suet, although you can get a vegetarian version. And it was years ago, a very long time ago, it was created with people using up things in their pantry, like so many of these kind of things were. And it's kind of a bit of a love it or hate it thing, really. But it's something that appears for us on a regular basis at Christmas time because it goes in our mince pies. Now, for me, right. I find it a bit much in that kind of concentrated way. I'm more interested in the pastry. But yeah, so what I did last week was actually to just put an entire jar in some dough. And it's almost jam-like in the consistency because you've got that liquid running through it. So by putting it in some dough, actually, what I produced was a fruit loaf, basically. So I had a standard sourdough that I would make and just shoved the whole jar in to see what it would do. And the flavors and the ingredients and everything mixed through it, and you create a version of a fruitcake.
Oh, that's so cool. So you mixed it right into the dough, like inclusions. You didn't layer it and then roll it.
No, I've done that before as well, because I've done it making a babka. So a few years ago, I have an enriched sourdough recipe. So you've got milk, butter, eggs in it. And I used that and rolled it out and filled it with mincemeat. But no, often the way that my recipes are created is I start making a dough and I look in the cupboard and think, oh, what have I got? What could I shove in and see what it does? And in this situation, this time it was a whole jar of mincemeat. So I put the whole 400 gram jar in. So the dough was... It was a bit soft. You couldn't stretch it. You couldn't shape it, which is why I baked it in a bundt tin. I mean, it came out really well. It's the kind of thing for me, I would eat with cheese because I need to offset the sweetness. But it is literally like making a fruit loaf, you know, slap some butter on it and you've got a winner.
There you go. But it is, in all seriousness, with minced meat, the two are the same. Like, there is a version of minced meat that does have meat in it, especially from the old days.
Yes.
I believe it was prepared that way. And
and it would have been something to preserve old meat or use old meat up.
Exactly. Right.
But what I found interesting is when I was producing a recipe with mince meat in, because my publisher is in the States, she wasn't too sure that enough people in the US would know what it was. But when I put it out, I found actually a lot of people do, but often a lot of the older generation in the States knew what I was talking about with mincemeat. And that their mothers...
It's funny. Right. I just literally, you know, I was joking at the beginning, but I do remember like hearing it in cartoons and things where people would use it as a threat. But I don't think a lot of people in my generation, we certainly, it's not a staple here. We don't eat it often. I don't think people know what it is, to be honest with you. I think they've all heard it and they might be curious like I was to look it up, and it sounds actually pretty cool.
It's worth a try. But you can always replace it like with a pecan pie filling, or just with, you know, some jam, what I would call jam, you might call jelly, and put in some dried fruits and peels and stuff like that. So you can create the same kind of, you know, texture and the flavor with it.
Right. So listen, I believe your third book is about to come out. Is it your third?
Yes.
Right. So I have here a copy of your second book, The Sourdough Whisperer, which is a phrase that I think a lot of your friends refer to you as.
Yeah.
And I had an opportunity to read this book, and I read a lot of books on baking, and I love this book because it is written in a simple way. There's not a lot of fancy terms that can be overwhelming for the beginning baker. And I just love how you have your measurements in both volume and weight. I don't see that much anymore. And I love how you explain all the tools you need. And you start essentially with a master recipe.
Yeah.
Which a lot of things springboard off of. And I kind of love that. Can you tell me why you do that and how you kind of fell into that using the master recipe and that idea?
I am, as you say, I'm a self-taught baker. I was challenged years ago to have a go at making sourdough. I didn't know what it was, never heard of it, gave it a go, and it worked well. And my son is a big bread fan, loved it, and wanted me to keep making it. So I wasn't doing this for any particular reason. I wasn't on social media. I wasn't online. I was just doing stuff at home. And I got to a point where I had created, or I was working with, a way of making sourdough that was consistent and simple and tidy. I don't do mess. I don't flour everywhere. And it was working. And I was producing loaves for my son on a daily basis. And I then decided, I got to a point in life where my husband was traveling a lot with work. My son got to an age where he didn't need me so much around and I wanted to do a bit more. And I'd had a food blog for years, but nothing to do with sourdough. So I rejoined Facebook and found these Facebook groups and all these people doing stuff. And I started posting and sharing things. And I suddenly got all these comments from people saying, "Oh, you break all the rules. You can't do it like that." And I was stunned because I had no idea that I was doing anything different. I was just sharing what I was doing in my kitchen. And I realized as well that from this point, from the single recipe, you could just do anything. So from that starting point, and I said to my husband, I'm gonna create a website. I'm gonna put my recipe on it. And I already had the name Food Bod from my food blog years ago. And I was creating tabs for the pages. And I just thought, I'm just going to call this Master Recipe. So it was no big ploy. It's no big marketing thing. It was just me creating my website, which I'd also never done before, and just calling it something. And it's taken on a life of its own. So I see people posting about it and just calling it the MR. I'm talking about the Master Recipe, which is amazing. You know, it's a huge honor, but it gives you a perfect starting point. From that point of that recipe, every recipe I've ever created has started there. And so you can manipulate it and do so many different things with it from that point.
It's funny. I do that with pizza dough. I don't necessarily do it with sourdough, only because when I started sourdough, I was checking out like, all right, this is how I'm going to make my rustic sourdough. And I looked at another recipe for whole wheat sourdough.
Yeah.
And I probably did what a lot of people do. Now, with pizza dough, and I'm 3 years into baking bread daily, and with pizza dough, I do have a basis to start, and then I'll do things where I'll substitute different flours, or I'll put in cocoa powder to make a dessert pizza with, and it's all off of the basic, you know, main pizza recipe I do.
And this is, you know, I get people messaging me and they will say, like you've just said, how do I make a whole wheat sourdough? Or how do I make a cheese and jalapeno sourdough? You go, well, just take my master recipe and add to it, or take some from it. You don't actually need whole new recipe. Once you've got that starting point and that basis, you can make it whatever you want it to be.
Yeah. It's as simple as that. I was talking to a guest last week, Patrick Duffy, when he was young, he would roll them out and he would put fruit and jam in these little rolls and he would bake them and he would make fruit tarts and he just, you know, just thought of it out of his head, right? And it was the same recipe.
Yeah,
so take your master recipe and do the same thing.
Absolutely. And the whole ethos of my book is that pure simplicity. So it's to, you know, I don't use fancy phrases, like you said. I don't use percentages. I don't use ratios. I don't do any of that. I just write how I do things in my kitchen. That's all I've ever done. And
yeah.
Once you get that understanding, so people will say to me, you know, they've made their first loaf. Well, what can I do with this now? Can I do this? And I'd be like, hold on. First of all, just master and understand the process. Understand what you're doing. So like you said, you know, you people will think they want to make sourdough and then they'll go down a rabbit hole because there's so much information. So I will always say choose a single source. Stick with it and understand what it is that you're making, how a starter works, how the dough works. Once you've got that, then do what you like with it. You know, then fly.
Exactly.
Then chuck what you want in it, chuck it around, do whatever. But just understand the process of how it works first, how it's going to work in your kitchen and with your flour, and then you can fly. You can do whatever you like with it.
I see you use the word chuck it in. Is that a British word that's often used, or is this you?
No, it's British, just to chuck something together. Or yeah, I suppose you could say throw something together, but yeah, just chuck it in the
Exactly.
Bar. Yeah,
and
yeah.
We use the word chuck too, but you use it often. I love it.
My upbringing and my background means I'm not really from anywhere, so I have all sorts of influences that come into my language, I suppose. And it's when I first started having my food blog and you start to converse with a really international group of people and these different things come into your language. And now I can see, I always say fab, you know, if someone's made something brilliant, I see, you know, oh, fab, I love that. And I can see fab, now other people around the world using that term because they've seen me use it so often. So it's, you know, it's the influences of things you hear and read, isn't it?
It is. Now, I'm curious to hear more about what it means that you're not really from anywhere. This is something I haven't discovered or found in any of my research. Tell me a bit about that.
I write about sourdough. I don't necessarily write about me.
Well, let's hear about you, if you don't mind, for a minute.
Only because I was born in the UK, but I only lived here for 4 months before my family moved to Europe. And my dad's job meant that we moved backwards and forwards a lot. So I was, you know, if you think years ago, back, you know, I was born in 1971, a KLM flight when they've got the baby carrier in the overhead thing. So I'm, you know, 4 months old in the overhead thing on a KLM flight to Holland.
Wow. Oh my God.
Yeah. So we lived there for a bit. We lived back here for a bit. We lived all over the UK, then back over there for a bit, then back here for a bit. And then I moved to the Middle East. I moved to Dubai when no one had ever heard of it. I moved in 1984 when it was mostly desert and you had to point it out on a map because no one had heard of it. And then ended up back here in different parts of the UK. So you know, ideally there's, what do you call someone that's not really got a basis anywhere, you know, kind of not really from anywhere.
Wow. In moving around with your family, did you ever spend time in big cities?
Yeah. And we did a lot. So when you live in Europe, you tend to drive all over the place.
Yeah.
So having lived in Holland twice, we drove and visited a lot of places. When we went out to the Middle East and it was seen as a hardship to live in Dubai, whatever flights you got often came with stopovers and packages. So if you flew with, you know, Thai Airways, you got stopovers thrown. If you flew with Malaysian Airways, you got stopovers thrown in from there. So, you know, we had stopovers in Hong Kong, stopovers in Singapore. So you got to visit lots of places. And these are, you know, I also had parents that were very keen on us trying different foods. So I had a lot of influence of trying different foods and different cultures and influences in my childhood, which is what you see seep into a lot of the things I do as well.
Yeah. Now, how far are you from a big city? I've been to England. It's not that big. I'm assuming you're in within a 2-hour drive from a big city.
Oh, probably closer. I live in the most landlocked place in the UK, in Britain, anyway, because I'm right in the middle. But I'm only an hour from London. I'm just an hour north of London, you know, and then an hour down from Birmingham. So yeah, big cities all over the place, but London, for me to get to London, I can get on a train in 40 minutes.
Now, where you live, do they have farmers markets and do they have vendors and do they have bread makers selling sourdough?
They have a lot of farmers markets. I think there's the odd person selling sourdough. I've never bought any to be able to tell you, but we do have, you know, I'm in a very rural area, so there are a lot of farmers markets. I work with people that are very keen on regenerative farming. So, you know, there is that big influence all around us.
Wow. Here, when you have a farmer's market, like there's always the staple vendors. There's always a bread vendor. There's always a honey vendor. There's always a produce vendor.
Yeah. It's
very, very common
around here. And we would have the same here. There's always baking stuff. Yeah, I know. And quite a few of my bakers have now started to sell their loaves and they will go to markets or they set up subscriptions and they sell out, you know, in no time because sourdough is so popular.
Yeah, that's great. Now, you talked about people would tell you broke the rules. I'm curious, you know, when I look at your book, that didn't jump out to me. Mm. I'm not saying that's not the case. What are those rules that they're implying you break?
Exactly. I mean, what are the rules and who determined what they were? You know, and where's the siren and the sourdough police knocking on my door?
Sourdough police. That's a good one.
I was stunned. And actually, I've recently been at the end of it again. You know, I get it on a regular basis, which I find quite fascinating. There is a snobbishness in sourdough, but...
Oh,
dreadful. But, you know, and we're just making bread. I have a very close private community in my Facebook group that we don't do criticism. We don't do anything like that. You know, we're just making bread. That's all it's about. And I don't care how you make it. If you love it and you're happy with what you've produced, I don't care if you've done it standing on your head. You know, the point is that we're just making bread. But because I don't use ratios to feed my starter. I don't portion bits out. I don't measure bits out. I take a base amount of starter. I always have the same small amount and I feed my starter based on what I want it to produce. So therefore, I never have any waste. I never have any discard. I don't make a levain. I don't keep the salt out for later. I chuck everything in the bowl at once. I don't shape on a counter. I just do it all in the bowl. One of the biggies as well is I don't preheat my oven. I chuck it all in a cold oven and then turn it on. As you can see, a lot of what I do is I chuck this and I chuck this out.
I know. I love it.
But it's all those things, you know. So even yesterday I had a message from someone saying, I'm so nervous about doing a cold start. I can't believe that would work. You know, you've got my book. Everything in that book that I've baked, everything I share has been made and baked in the way that I write. I, you know, mm-hmm. I don't preheat my oven. It just goes in, then I turn it on. you know, there's so many, but like I always say to people, there's so many ways of doing this. Find the way that you love. So the whole rules thing, you know, there's a lot of people have made a lot of money out of writing very complicated ways of making sourdough. I don't get the point. Life's too short. Let's just make it as simply as we can and make bread that we like. But having said that, if science is your thing and you want to make it in a different way and you want to get involved in that, then go for it. You know, we're just making something for ourselves and our family to eat.
Yeah. I think there's a place for the science, and I think there's a certain consistency that they figure out. I mean, you're consistent for you because you've been consistently doing a process. And I share a lot of the process. Some of my process is very different than yours, but I also, I guess I break the rules because I don't do a lot of the things that people do. But
so
I
do
can
you have
tell you...
knocking on your door?
I have had certain comments from people, and you know, there's also a different taste in my sourdough. That's something I want to get with you. My sourdough isn't particularly sour, based on how I started doing this. And listen, at the end of the day, I make bread in bulk. I scale it up, and I go to these farmers markets. So a lot of what I came up with was out of convenience for me to be able to do that while I do my main job.
Yeah.
And also not having a big background in sourdough. And there's this thing in the States with San Francisco sourdough, which seems to be what people believe is the standard with this very sour tasting bread that's almost overly sour, in my opinion. That being said, my customers love my bread and people line up for it, and it isn't particularly sour. I'm curious where you live. Is that a thing? Is San Francisco sourdough a phrase and a term that's used in Europe?
Not particularly. I will see people ask about it because they've heard about it or read about it. Usually it's probably coming from people in the States because of, you know, the sourdough is years ago and it became called San Francisco. It's very much, there's a belief that's where it was born from when, you know, actually sourdough is thousands of years old.
Absolutely.
And the flavor thing, you know, you can manipulate the flavor of sourdough to be whatever you want because, again, there is no right and wrong here. So, you know, if your customers are happily eating your sourdough, then you're obviously doing something fabulously right.
I even had someone post about it recently. If you love sourdough with that without that extremely sour taste, this is the sourdough company for you.
And I will get two different sets of messages. I will get people messaging me saying, how do I make it more sour? How do I make it less sour? A lot of members of their family want something less sour. They want something that's, you know, not as hard to eat. I've had quite a few people who've broken their teeth on sourdough crusts.
Oh, that's another thing here too.
Yeah, it's all about the manipulation of it. And I think that's the other thing is understanding the key ethos behind that book, behind my second book, was wanting people to understand that they are in control. You are fully in control of the dough. You're in control of how you make this bread. The dough does not control you. And that's a big thing.
And I got that. I got that out of your book. And I did want to get to that. And it seems like, in the most simple terms, tell me if I got this right, you replace an amount of water with milk, and you're automatically going to have a softer bread to some extent.
Yep.
Right?
Because as soon as you put some fat in the dough, then it's going to be softer. So if you replace, if you particularly want a softer loaf, then replace a portion or all of the water with milk, and you will immediately have a softer and less sour loaf.
Right. Interesting. I will say, like, my sourdough is pretty dense. It's like you could squeeze it and it'll give you a little, but it's very different than getting a sandwich loaf in the supermarket that you could literally go like that with. I haven't done a lot of sourdough with milk.
Again, it's something that's just worth trying just to see, because you'll also get a slightly darker color because the fat will bake darker.
Right.
You know, from what you said about sourdough versus shop-bought bread, it's like if you toast sourdough, it takes forever. because it doesn't have, right. It's not skinny, it's not light like shop-bought bread, and it doesn't have sugar put in it. So shop-bought bread has got sugar added to it so that it will brown. And we don't necessarily have that in sourdough, not as a standard recipe. So it is something, you know, it is something meaty. It's something that you can get stuck into and not just swallow without realizing that you've eaten it.
Right. Now, another thing I love about what you talked about is shaping. There's so much discussion on the right way to shape and what shaping does. And then you say, chuck it in a bundt pan.
Shaping is something that, again, there's so many convoluted ways of doing it and so many videos on shaping. So if I make a standard loaf, a standard bowl, I will have my dough in the bowl. I pull it into a tight ball and stick it in the bannison.
I don't know if anyone's watching the video of this, but you go like this and you squeeze it almost like in a knot, right?
Yeah, so you just pull it really tightly together, pick it up and plunk it in the bannison. So again, I will get people messaging me and saying, don't you shape your dough? Like, yes, that's it right there. And then the bannison does the rest of the job for you. But one of the key reasons I wrote my third book is because shaping is such an issue and it's so scary for people, is I wanted to take that out of the domain and actually create doughs that were either needed hardly any kind of action to shape them, or use tins, use what you've got in your kitchen. You know, open your cupboard, see what tin have I got. You know, that's hence me baking sourdough in a bundt tin. It's just shove it in and see what it does. So, you know, because people will also message me and go, but if you make sourdough that's got milk and butter in it, is it still sourdough? Yes, anything that's made with a starter is sourdough. That's what it's about, is the starter and what the texture and flavor gives you from that. So it doesn't matter what shape it ends up in or what kind of pan you bake it in, it's all still sourdough. So yes.
See, I have this conversation with customers a lot because, at farmers markets, we're in a pretty densely populated area. So they're not necessarily coming there. A percentage of people are coming there for us and for our bread, and a percentage of people happen to be there. And they don't know a lot about bread. And it relates to that sour taste also. And I am constantly explaining, it's a rising agent. It's just the oldest way people have made bread for years before there was commercial yeast available.
Yep.
Flour, water, fermented over time, allows bread to rise.
Yep.
And it happens to be better for your digestive system. But it's a rising agent. That's really what it is.
And it is. And if I say to people about sourdough, or the point I make to them is, the only difference, the thing to keep in mind with sourdough is just the length of time. That's all the difference is. So you've still got your raising agent, like you said. So that's what your starter is in this case. You know, if you were using commercial yeast, it takes a couple of hours. By using sourdough, it's a longer process. And that's the only difference to take into account, is because you might prove something for 8, 10, 12 hours, is understanding that whatever happens during that time can affect your dough. So if there are changes of temperature or changes of environment, that can affect your dough. Just like you would, if you're sitting around for 8 to 10 hours and it gets hot or it gets cold, it's going to change how you feel. And the dough is exactly the same. So yes. Yeah. That your starter is just your raising agent. It's just pushing it up. So when you feed, when you create a dough, you put it all together, you're basically giving your starter the biggest feed of its life. So you just need to give it more time to respond to it.
Right. I want to jump into the feeding in a second, but before we do that, and I figured this out along the way for several different reasons, but you could actually take every recipe in your book and make it with commercial yeast.
Yeah,
you can, right? And I've figured that out. I found recipes that were written for commercial yeast that I've then just used a sourdough rising agent instead.
Yeah, you can.
I do it all the time.
Yeah.
Yep. You can convert it. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned feeding the starter, and I like how you talk about that in your book. You know, people are overwhelmed sometimes before they even start and don't start because they're like, I can't keep this thing alive. What do I have to do? So let's jump ahead. If I give someone a jar of my sourdough starter and it's already active, or it's gone through the original 10-day fermentation process, what's your take on feeding starter from there? And how do you keep it going?
You just feed it when you want to use it, because it's already a live active starter. There's nothing else you need to do to it. So when you want to make some dough, feed it accordingly. When it's risen, take out what you want and then stick it in the fridge.
Well, what about time? Like, let's say I'm a casual sourdough maker and I want to make sourdough once a month.
Yeah. That's fine.
Now what?
It again, just leave it in the fridge. You don't need to feed a starter unnecessarily. You don't need to feed it to keep it alive. You can just leave it in the fridge for all that time. So I only use my starter once a week. I batch bake. So I only feed it once a week. And in between time, it's just living in the fridge. I've had people have their starters in the fridge for months without use. They get it out, feed it, might need once or twice, and it's ready to go. So there is this fear factor about starters, but they're actually really difficult to kill. They're really quite resilient, and they do bounce back, because all you're doing when you put it in the fridge is putting it to sleep. You're giving it a hiatus so that when you then bring it out and feed it, it can rise up again. So, yeah, for me, there's none of that waste thing, none of that feeding it unnecessarily. Just only feed it when you want to use it.
So the key there is the refrigerator.
Yes. Cold. The cold is your friend, because the cold brings everything to a halt.
I didn't know that at the beginning, and I used to keep it on the counter and it got really watery.
It will.
And I killed that one. And then I discovered the refrigeration later on, and it is amazing. I'm about to go on a vacation, and in the past, I've had people come into my home, and I've trained them just on a week's vacation how to come in and feed my starter. So I don't have to worry about that anymore.
You don't, because it doesn't need all that looking after. The only time you need to do anything daily with a starter is when you're making it. Once it's established, it doesn't need all of that input. And, you know, by leaving it on the counter, yes, it would have got thin. It would have become inactive because it was getting too hot. So the biggest lesson for me when I was learning about sourdough, when I was making my own, was that understanding of the connection between temperature and sourdough. That's why I have thermometers all over my kitchen, because they help plan. So once you understand that the cold slows it down and brings it to a halt, the heat speeds it up, actually, it makes so much more sense.
Absolutely. What about scoring? I saw in one of your loaf pan breads.
Yeah.
I think it was a sandwich bread. There was no score at all.
No.
And I was wondering, how does that, was that trial and error? Did you just do it? Because sometimes scoring does allow the bread to open up and, I don't know, not split at the bottom. What's your take on scoring in general?
Definitely. If I'm making a freeform loaf, I would always score, and I would encourage people to score, because you help it grow.
Mm-hmm.
And you help it to actually get to the size it wants to. And it's, I don't know if you have the saying over here, they used to call it, let the devil out. Hence, when you score your dough, to encourage it to grow. Habitually, for me, when making a sandwich loaf, I never have scored. And if you look at sandwich loaves in a shop, they tend to have scoring on them. And I think because they are baked differently, you bake them at a lower temperature, you're baking them open, quite a different process. So you can, whenever people message me and say, why don't you, or can I score my sandwich loaf? Of course. But what you often find is that the scores close up, because it's not got that same space in which to grow.
Right. I don't do a lot of pan baking. And I guess part of it is because I'm baking in higher quantities and I've got I have a 10 pan oven that I could bake every other row, and I'm trying to put out volume. Wow. And I'm placing about 5 loaves on a pan, and I don't have enough, you know, when a sheet pan, right? I don't have enough Dutch ovens, and I'm not doing that, so I have to do it the way. And again, I kind of just came up with a system. I'm self-taught as well.
But I think with the loaf tin, I get different people want something that's going to fit in their toaster, hence using, you know, a loaf pan. People that really are fed up with trying to shape something are happily shoving it in a loaf tin. But also, like at the moment, you know, the cost of keeping your oven on in this country anyway, if you're going to do multiple bakes, and, you know, our ovens are smaller than yours. I have 2, but one of mine, you know, is probably half the size of yours. They're only 500 wide. So we can fit 3 loaf tins in at the same time in a standard British oven. So actually that helps us to be able to bake a lot more at once. So, you know, there is, and it depends on the household, what people want them for. Sometimes people want it for, you know, sandwiches, and they don't want it to be a weird size and have holes in it. They want it to be something that can hold, you know, what they want to put in it.
Yeah. I love that conversation about the holes, because I do think the customers don't care about the holes. And I think it's the sourdough police that care about the holes.
The holes, the ears, all of it, the blisters, all of it. And, you know, and they don't add flavor. And actually, if you've got big holes in your bread, there's probably a reason for it. But also, you would just end up with the butter in your lap. You know, exactly. If you want bread or air. Yeah.
That's what my customers say. They don't care about the big holes. But, you know.
And they, you know, do they want to pay for holes or pay for bread?
But then, you know, you're judged because you're not an artisan baker unless you constantly post photos of open crumb.
Yeah. And again, you know, that's just not what I allow in my group or people that post things. You know, they will post a loaf that they're in love with and they'll go, I know it's not perfect. No, but actually, it is. If you love it, it's perfect. If you're happy, it tastes good, you're excited about it, it is perfect. That's all that matters, not whether so-and-so thinks it should have a great big hole in it. Because, you know, often, you know, big holes like that are often a result of a proving issue or a shaping issue. They're not always artisan creations.
Right. Yeah, not always. But, you know, there are... we both know there are amazing bakers that go for that, and they do know what they're doing. And, you know, it's just,
oh, absolutely. It's, and I'm not, you know, yeah. I'm very aware that I'm going to be saying things that people aren't going to like, but you know, there are, I'm good at that. You know, there's ways and ways of making things, and there are people that can create these amazing looking breads.
Yeah.
And they're picture perfect, and they, you know, man, the skill in it is absolutely stunning. And I'm not taken away from that at all.
Absolutely. So I am going to be taking the winter off from farmers markets. It was like a long 6-7 months. And you don't have a lot of time under that schedule to experiment and try things and add things to the arsenal. I am intrigued by the bread, the loaf with buttermilk that you did. Does buttermilk, because it's really fat, make it soft?
No, it's just because I had some in my fridge that needed using up.
Oh, okay. Got
but
it.
But yes, once I used it once, I realized how nice it was. And you, again, you have the fat in it. You have the flavor that comes from buttermilk. But something that I'd done as a first experiment years ago was actually I took a portion of my starter out and I fed it with buttermilk and flour to see what it would do. And it makes, you know, the starter it creates is amazing. You know, the texture in it is brilliant. So again, it was just to show, you know, my first book has a chapter in called Swap the Water, was to make the point that you don't have to have water. So hence, that was where my first buttermilk came from, buttermilk loaf. I have a beer loaf. I have a loaf made with the cooking liquid from cooking potatoes. you know, you can use cooking liquid from cooking pasta, anything.
Really?
Can be your liquid. Oh, yeah, anything. Rather than waste it, you know, actually, if you use the liquids that you've used to cook pasta in or vegetables, the extra starch in that, actually, the dough loves it and it grows really well. And you get just, a different texture, a different, you know, feel to the bread. And it's, again, we're coming back to what are these supposed rules? It can be anything. So whatever you've got, you know, if you get, we're coming up to Christmas now as we speak. If you end up after the festive period with random different things in your fridge, different drinks or whatever, chuck them in your dough and see what happens.
You know, that's great. I got to tell you, I got into this and I do this on the side because I love it. And now I'm like, the schedule I've been under to accommodate these multiple farmers markets and hundreds of loaves have kind of taken away some of the fun of trying these types of things.
But so, you don't get a chance to experiment, do you? Because you need to be consistent and provide what your customers want.
Right, not as often. Right, not as often. There's too much at stake, you know, because you have to meet the schedule. And it's so many hours of... Because even with the large size ovens I have, it's small compared to a commercial baker. And we are putting out almost as much as some commercial bakers. So it's kind of not even...
And that's amazing. I mean, I don't do that. I don't sell bread. I wouldn't be able to do that. So that's a huge thing that you're doing, especially on your own.
I don't know if it's good or bad. It's huge, yeah. I don't know if it's a good thing. It's kind of like things kind of blew up here in the house yesterday. My wife helps a lot. There's so many logistics that go. I work on the baking, and I do have some help and people that come in. But then, you know, we do deliveries. We have a couple of restaurant accounts, and
wow,
and it's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah,
it's a lot.
And I think as soon as people know, and I see that with my bakers that are thinking of turning it into a business, and they just start to float the idea, and suddenly they've got orders, they've got subscriptions, they've got interest.
Yeah.
And I think as soon as you raise a flag and say, I'm doing this, people are interested.
They are. And I'm still interested. I just would like to figure out for me what the balance of it is, you know? What do we do with it? We're at the place where the balance is a little off. We can't keep the logistics the way they are and the help. Like, we need real help. We need, you know, because that gets frustrating too when you have the help and you're constantly training people on, because how much of the dough texture, like, you know, by feeling and looking at it, right? That takes a long time to teach somebody.
And, you know, when people have ever asked me if I sell it, you know, I've always been more interested in teaching people how to make their own, but also because, yes, you know how your dough feels, you know how it works, you know how it lives and breathes, and to try and train that into someone else, it's going to take quite a long time. They need a lot of experience of touching and feeling and smelling and seeing the dough.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's an awful lot to let go of.
And then it's like, there are times where I just can't be here. Not often, but you know, someone does have to cover me on it, even if it's one of my kids, and I have a pit in my stomach because, you know, it's got my name on it. We're known for a certain thing. Is it going to be the same? There's a very good chance it's not. And I feel like I want to be the one to do it, you know?
I totally get that. But this is like when I put my recipes out there, and I will often get people that will say, I've made your recipe to a T and it doesn't work. It hasn't worked. And they go, okay. You know, before you go posting that all over Facebook, can you just tell me what you did? And they'll say, you know, well, I did this bit and I did this bit. I didn't do that bit and I changed that bit, but I did all the rest. And there is a leap of faith there because, you know, every recipe I put out is being tested and tried by people all over the world.
Yeah.
Different flours, different kitchens, different environments. That's why I provide so much help and so many tips. That's why I can tell you what flour to use in whatever country you ask me about, because I've had so many conversations with people. So as soon as you put something out there that's got your name on it, The difference is, I suppose, for me, is it's other people making the recipes in their kitchens. Whereas for you, it's all got your name on it coming from your kitchen.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. In the U.S., you use a lot of bread flour in your recipes. Do you recommend? I use King Arthur flour. Is that one of the ones you would recommend?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I did a bread swap with one of my bakers so I could try it. And it's very, very much like the bread flour that I use here. So King Arthur bread flour in the blue bag, perfect.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I really enjoyed this book, and I'm definitely getting your next book. When is it coming out?
Thank you. It will be out with you in the States in the spring, I think at the beginning of April.
Okay. Do you do any master classes or anything online?
You know, I haven't done yet, but it's in the pipeline. It's very much, yeah. I'm going to do a Zoom class with Milk Street at the beginning of February, which I think will be interesting. But the first time I try something like that, and I think that could be the catapult for me. Because I had someone post in a group yesterday saying, you know, I need you to come to Oklahoma. And then everybody started posting, I need you to come to New Zealand. I need you to come to Australia. I need you to come to New York, which would be lovely to do. But if I can do something virtually, it would make probably a lot more sense. So that's what I'm hoping to work on.
Yeah, virtually would be great. I would love that. I would certainly attend. But, you know, a nice little book tour through the States might be fun. Sell some books, have the publisher pay for it.
I've had a lot of offers for a lot of places that I could stay. So, you know, I've already got the bed and board sorted.
That could be a TV show. Staying with the bakers that follow you.
I have a film crew following me. See how we get on. Yeah.
You never know. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much for joining me here. Wish you and your family and Bob a happy holiday.
Thank you. And likewise to all of your family. And thank you very much for having me on. I hope it's of interest to your listeners.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to go upstairs now and chuck some stuff into the dough.
That's going to be your word now.
It is. All right. Have a great day.
All right. Thank you very much, Jim.
This episode of Bread for the People was brought to you by Side Hustle Bread, Long Island's handcrafted artisanal bread company. Side Hustle Bread is a family-run business that's bringing the neighborhood feel back to Long Island one loaf at a time. If you like what you're hearing, don't forget to head on over to iTunes and rate and review this episode. Reviewing and rating is the most effective way to help us grow our audience. This episode was produced by Milestone TV and Film. I'm your host, Jim Serpico. Blessed be the bread, everyone.